Welcome to A New Republic, an oral history of the Indian Constitution. Episode 5, A Little Debate. Welcome back. So in this episode of the podcast, I'm going to shake up the format a little bit. And I'm going to bring into the show a second voice. So what is the second voice going to do? Now, so far, we've discussed the history of the Indian Constitution between the periods of the Revolt of 1857 and the First World War. And in this episode, we look at a little bit of the important area we've covered so far, but also look ahead to the story of the Constitution after the First World War. And I'm going to do this in conversation with Rohit Day. Now, before I talk to you about Rohit, why do I need a second voice? Now, I have two reasons. The first one is to break the monotony of just having to listen to me. A second voice will spice things up a little bit. And secondly, which is the more important reason, is I want to make sure that you're not entirely enslaved to my amateur analysis. So hopefully, when people like Rohit, they come on board, they'll give you differing perspectives, and I might disagree with him on various aspects, which I think is good, and which gives you different things to think about. So who is Rohit? Rohit is a Mellon postdoctoral fellow at the Center for History and Economics at Cambridge University, and will soon receive his PhD from Princeton. And according to his website, and I quote, his current research explores how the Indian Constitution, despite its elite authorship and alien antecedents, came to permeate everyday life and imagination in India during its transition from a colonial state to a post-colonial republic. Very nice. Also, incidentally, Rohit teaches elements of constitutional history at a couple of law schools in India. Now, during our initial email exchange, Rohit made an interesting observation. He said that scholarly interest in India in the constitution had somewhat waned starting from the 1970s. So that is what we started our conversation with. What led to this waning of interest?
So perhaps I should have clarified my comments. By interest, I mean interests by historians who stopped sort of looking at constitutional history as an area to work on. Lawyers, because of the bread and butter, have always been writing about the constitution. So the reason why historians sort of stopped looking at the constitution in the 70s, there's sort of three interconnected reasons. The first is, in some ways, when you think of the constitutional narrative, in fact, it comes through even when I listen to your programs. So you sort of begin the story with sort of with British legislation. So in that sense, it sort of gives a lot of credence to a British argument that, you know, what the British were doing were merely preparing people for self-governance, and the constitution is somewhat an inevitable step to a series of reforms that have been happening for many years. So people wanted to break out of this narrative, sort of try to focus on other things to show what happens with the independence movement was actually very different and not necessarily a sort of progression, a slow steps from the British. The second sort of area of critique came from a move in sort of history writing more generally, where the emphasis was on thinking about lives of common people and not about things that kings and ministers do. So the constitution was seen as sort of particularly high politics and not seen as something that, you know, there's much that people can speak about. But perhaps what's most profound was the 70s was also when the emergency happened, and there's a degree of disillusionment with the form of the Indian state and the constitution. And the argument is that the constitution is unable to prevent something like the emergency. Therefore, law by itself or words by themselves have very little meaning. Ultimately, what works is sort of structures of power and economics. So the constitution in particular and law in general was very epiphenomenal. And, you know, it's just about class or it's just about caste. It's not, it doesn't have a particular meaning in itself. It can be used very instrumentally by other people.
But just how valid are these three critiques? Now, remember, the first one is applicable to this podcast. I have depended on British antecedents to largely tell the story so far. So this is Rohit again on those three specific critiques of constitutional history.
So maybe I should take them one by one. I mean, to an extent, all of them are true. I mean, that's undeniable. However, such an approach sort of misses out on two things. One is that ideas have a power in themselves. And secondly, that the constitution that came up in 1950 was not just a product of these sort of series of British acts that appeared one after the other. Going back to Tilak in 1895, there were attempts by different groups of Indians to imagine sort of alternative constitutions. And what happens in 1950 is an amalgamation of various different kinds of sort of streams. So one clearly is this British legislative stream, mm-hmm. but there's also sort of a Congress-produced sort of political stream. There's a social movement stream, which includes Gandhians and groups like women's groups, which have been advocating. So all of them come and feed into the narrative. And, the last bit, and that's something that my work right now deals with, is that it's very hard. I think people can't, it became, we all, whether we want to or not, have to deal with the Constitution in some way or the other. It could be something as simple as, supposing you're a businessman and you find that the government refuses you a permit. One of the ways in which you can challenge the fact that a permit was not given to you is to appeal to constitutional norms. Alternatively, if you're a schoolgirl, and this is a case from Bombay in the 50s, and the Bombay government passes a rule saying that you can only study in your mother tongue, and this girl wants to study in English, one of the few recourses she and her parents have is to turn to this constitutional language. So I think that it might very well be originally a product of certain sets of interests, but once it goes into operation, it allows for other people to participate in it. There's a great analogy this guy called Sandy Levinson makes on the American Constitution, and he says there are two ways of reading the Constitution. One is the Catholic way, which is, you have an institutional version that is given and you have to all accept it. Mm-hmm. And the Protestant way, which, each of you sort of pick up the Constitution as your text, and you decide what is it that, what words these have, what meaning a particular section has to you. So it's a it doesn't necessarily, and in fact, very often the Constitution functions in ways in which people in power can't always predict. So there have been moments where they've equally been surprised by it. So I think it's a more complicated story, and I think to dismiss it as something that is only sort of imperial or class interest is selling the narrative short. So.
Now that I'd gotten that bit of a critique of constitutional history out of the way, I asked Rohit how important this early part of the constitution history was. And I'm referring to the bits we've handled so far on this podcast. That is the early acts between the onset of the British Raj and the breakout of the First World War. How important were these bills and acts, and what lasting legacy did they have on the constitution? In other words, when we drew up the Constitution in 1950, were there any remnants of these early reforms in them?
So, there is something called path dependency that economists and political scientists talk about, which is if you set up certain structures early enough, it sort of shapes how further structures come in. So to that extent, in terms of how the shape of sort of the broad architecture of the state looks, so there's a government in the center, there's a sort of three or four step government in the provinces. Mm-hmm. All of that goes back to this period. And essentially what a lot of these reforms, where these come from, is after the revolt of 1857, there's a real sense that a government in India has to be sort of reorganized to make it more efficient and to enable central control over the provinces better. And it leads to a very powerful position of the Governor General in Delhi, and those sort of structures go back to that date. The other thing that you pointed out through a lot of these is there's a sort of push towards having some kind of what they would call native representation. And while at the level of the provincial governments or the central government, it's sort of very, very formal at the most. Most of these positions are filled by sort of landlords and maharajas who are sort of indebted to the British to begin with, or by retired civil servants. There is a degree of governance that is put forward in cities through the extension of powers to municipalities. And in some ways, this is where the site of a lot of politics is. So especially in cities like Bombay, Madras and Calcutta, the municipalities where the action is, people who we think of today as national leaders often sort of begin their careers in these forefronts, because it's one of the few bodies that has to some extent some limited power, and at least there's a possibility of contesting some kind of election, because it's a very limited franchise, but there is some franchise. Mm-hmm. So if you're between wealthy landowning men of the cities, there's a sort of public sphere that's emerging. And it feeds in very well to, if you look at sort of the growth of Congress politics or nationalist politics in the period, a lot of it, even under Tilak and the so-called extremist members of the Congress, was in cities amongst this group of people who were finding themselves impatient with the pace of change from the government. So they're trying to push for other sort of non-constructive tactics as well. But in a way, some of this was enabled by the fact that you had this kind of electoral forum in which, you know, you can make the claim to represent people. So one of the sort of things people often comment on is that unlike the West, there's been no sort of big debate about whether India should have been a democratic country or not.
Uh-huh.
And people argue that it was very hard for nationalists to not push for democracy or suffrage, because in some ways, the claim they begin making from the late 19th century is that the reason why the logic behind rule is not necessarily efficiency. The British could have ruled us more efficiently and they wouldn't have legitimized their rule anymore. The logic is that a people should be able to, you know, rule themselves. And even if you're an elite group of people making the argument, you have to at some point of time realize this argument has to sort of include everyone. So the sort of debate about adult franchise is actually a fairly seamless debate in India compared to countries of Western Europe. There's sort of no real, very little sort of crisis about do we give the poor the right to vote. And by the 1920s and 30s, that's sort of almost inevitable that that's going to happen.
Rohit covers a lot of interesting ground in that recording. I had to go back and listen to it a couple of times to get all of it myself, and so should you. It's actually quite interesting. Next, I wanted to move on to the next tranche in this story, which is the period during and just after the First World War. How important were these developments, these acts, these legislations? So I asked Rohit, and I put it to him in this way. I asked him, if the First World War hadn't taken place, would the story of India's constitutional history been very different? And this is what he had to say.
I mean, the easy answer is yes. It would have been, but it's hard to speculate what else it could have looked like. But the war basically reinforced several things. One is that it greatly weakened Britain in Europe and sort of made it more dependent on its colonies in terms of getting foodstuff, in terms of getting raw material. Secondly, the war had sort of, you know, the war ended with the Russian Revolution breaking out, sort of burst of socialist ideas and this sort of international demand for freedom and self-determination, which again sort of, you know, influenced people in India as well. And thirdly, the a lot of, for example, Indian soldiers had participated in the war and they would go to France or serve in France or in the Middle East. And it sort of made them very aware about their position in India. So there are these, there's work that's been done on letters by Indian soldiers who lived in France, writing back to their families in India, saying that, you know, we see the Europeans in Europe behave differently from the way they behave in India. Or they found sometimes they were treated better when they were abroad than they were treated inside India. And sort of this leads to a certain degree of popular nationalism that's coming out. So if you look at how the national movement expands just after the war, there's a much greater degree of popular participation that comes about. So it's sort of coming together with all these factors.
Rohit did go on to discuss both that history and aspects of the constitution, especially post-1935, in a telephone call. But I'm saving a lot of that for future episodes. I don't want to use up all the good stuff in one shot. Now, before letting him go, I touched upon one more topic, which, again, we spoke about in our initial emails. He said that the versions of the constitution that we finally see are not just directly resultant from British legislation and later on, draftings by certain elite Indians, they also incorporate aspects of an Indian constitution that were drawn up by all kinds of different people, including Bal Gangadhar Tilak, what Rohit Day referred to as previous versions. So I asked him, how important were these previous versions, and do we see any of them in the final draft Indian constitution?
The earliest sort of recorded earliest document we know about is something that was called the Swaraj Bill in 1895, I think. And I think this is authored by, or at least one of the authors is Bal Gangadhar Tilak. And importantly, the bill differs from sort of the British Constitution form in that it begins with laying out a Bill of Rights for all Indians. So rights that Indians would enjoy again and that would be protected against the state. And this is actually a common theme that comes through all the reports. So the next big document is something that's written by Annie Besant through the Home Rule League called the Commonwealth of India Bill, which actually gets introduced in the British Parliament in 1925 through a private member. And once again, this bill lays out not just things like civil and political rights that safeguard the individual from the state, but also puts in a whole degree of these social rights. So right to education, right to healthcare, basic sort of labor rights. So you see a coming in of sort of social welfare ideas in it. Around this time, after 1919 reforms, the 1919 reforms require that there's going to be a review after 10 years and a new constitution will come into place. And this commission of inquiry set up under Lord Birkenhead, and this is what's called the Simon Commission. And there's a lot of opposition to it by nationalists at this point of time who argue that a constitution of India must be written by Indians. And the British government sort of suggests that Indians are unable to write a constitution together. Famously, one of the British cabinet ministers said, perhaps the best thing that we can do is try to let the Indians write the actual constitution, and they'll realize that they can't work with each other, and their interests are they're far too many clashing interests. They'll never actually produce anything. And it's in this context that one has to look at moves like the Nehru Report. Which is an effort by Motilal Nehru drawing together almost every political party chair of in India to produce a fairly large constitution. And some of the things that carry on are these constitutions all provide for a very broad Bill of Rights encompassing not just traditional civil and political liberties, but also these new social welfare rights. Secondly, they all provide for a very powerful Supreme Court, which will enforce these rights against the government. And none of the sort of Government of India Act actually do a lot about increasing judicial powers. In fact, we see a reduction of powers of the judiciary from the late 19th century to the early 20th century because the government doesn't want the colonial judiciary to interfere with it very much. And the third, of course, there is a question of franchise. So, with each successive Indian authored report, there's a greater demand for extension of franchise. So I think by the Nehru Report, there's a demand for universal adult franchise, and this is sort of taken up again by the Congress in 32 in the session in Karachi. So, and there's also a very strong demand for, and this is the contentious demand, is how our constituency is going to be organized. And as you pointed out, in 1909, the reforms provided for separate electorates for Muslims. And this is something that became an issue a contentious issue between the Congress and the Muslim League in the 20s. And in a way, the Congress-produced documents always pushed for joint electorates for all communities. And they provided instead for reservations for groups like Muslims, Dalits, Christians, and Sikhs. So a lot of this actually you do find coming into the Constitution in 47. So we don't take separate electorates. We bring in a Bill of Rights. We bring in a powerful Supreme Court.
I hope you enjoyed those excerpts from my conversation with Rohit. That is about 30% of everything we spoke about. And you will hear him and some of those missing clips in the next few episodes of this podcast as we go along. Now, in the next episode, before we launch into more constitutional history, I will dwell a little bit on the First World War and India's role in it. Because I think it's one of those periods in our history that we really don't read about too much, but we should, because it affected the lives of millions of Indians, both directly as a part of military action and indirectly back home in India. And I think that experience of the First World War had a profound impact on our overall history and specifically our constitutional history. But more on that next time. Take care and see you then.